Fritzy, as her tongue dug out bits of candy from between her teeth.
Hello, stepmother, she said.
The queen's glare was focused on Jason. You are dismissed, Jason. Go find some way to be useful. Yes, your majesty, he said, still in his bow, and a second later, he was marching away from them, back toward the palace. The stiffness to his stride made Winter curious if he was mirroring the strut of the guards or if Lavanna was controlling his limbs.
Did you need something, stepmother?
Lavanna stared at her for a long time. A very long time. Winter could read nothing behind her glamour, her placid expression, her breathtaking beauty. She had heard some rumors lately that she, Winter, the gangly princess with the unruly hair, might someday surpass the queen's beauty. She laughed every time she heard such nonsense, knowing that it could only be empty flattery. Finally, one side of Lavanna's lips curled upward. Maybe it was meant to be comforting, but it failed. Come with me, Winter. She turned and headed back toward the palace without waiting to see if Winter would follow, because, of course, she would. You are spending too much time with that boy, Lavanna said as they stepped beneath the portico overhang and back into the bright-lit corridors of the palace. You are getting older. You are no longer a child, and soon you will have suitors and perhaps even requests for marriage. You must be aware of propriety and expectations. That is your role in this family. That is the part you will play on behalf of the crown. Winter kept her eyes focused on the floor. Nothing the queen was saying was news to her, but she had never broached the subject so openly. She did know what was expected of her, and marrying the son of a palace guard wasn't it. She ignored the fact that Lavanna herself had married a man from the working class when she'd been just a princess. Winter's father,
a lowly palace guard himself.
The sneers and derision from the court continued even to this day, 13 years after their marriage and 4 years after her father's death. It was a mistake that Winter would not be allowed to make for herself. She would marry for political gain. Jason would go off and become a doctor, and she might never see him again.
Of course, stepmother, she said. Jason is only a friend.
It was the truth. He was a friend, albeit one she would cut out her heart for. Lavanna took her to the elevator, and they rode it to the top floor, to the queen's solar, a private place that Winter had rarely entered. The room was beautiful, the highest place in all of Artemisia. The walls were made of glass, and she could see the entire city, all the way to the walls of the dome and beyond into the desolate landscape of Luna. Far off on the horizon, she spotted the glow of the other nearby sectors. It occurred to Winter, for the first time, how odd it was that her stepmother was alone. No thaumaturge loitering at her elbow, no simpering member of the court trying to earn her favor. Only a single guard was posted at the solar's door, and Lavanna sent him away. Winter's stomach began to churn. Master Gertman tells me that you have not been improving in your lessons, said Lavanna, floating around a desk. In fact, he says that you have not shown any sign of the lunar gift in nearly a year. Winter felt a sting of betrayal, though she knew it wasn't fair. The tutor was doing his job, and keeping the queen apprised of Winter's progress was a part of it. Her tutor could not be blamed for Winter's choices. Lowering her gaze, Winter did her best to look embarrassed.
It's true. I don't know what happened. I thought things were going well, but then... Well, there was that suicide. You remember? The servant who threw herself into the fountain?
What of it? Winter shrugged sadly.
I tried to stop her once before.
I used my gift to bring her away from the throne room ledge, and it worked. I thought I'd done so well, but then... After she died, it was as though my gift began to weaken. She frowned and shook her head.
I don't know what's wrong with me. I try so hard, but it's like my gift is broken.
To her surprise, Tears were starting behind her lashes. Quite the actress she was becoming. Lavanna sneered. She did not look even remotely sympathetic. I had hoped you would progress well and become a useful member of this court. But it seems that you might take after your father after all. She paused. You are aware that he was not adept at his gift either. Winter nodded.
Guards never are.
She had no idea if her mother, her biological mother, had been skilled with her gift. No one ever spoke of her, and she knew better than to ask. But we do know, don't we, that you are not as talentless as your father, because Master Gertman tells me that at one point you showed marvelous promise. In fact, he feels that you were once one of his most outstanding students. And he is as baffled as anyone over your current lack of ability. I wonder if this isn't all due to some psychological trauma, perhaps pertaining to that suicide.
Maybe, but I don't know how to fix it. Maybe I need to see a doctor rather than a tutor.
Winter barely smothered her own smirk. A doctor? What might they prescribe for the girl who was going crazy, who heard monsters clawing at her door nearly every night? But she would not mention that. She knew what was wrong with her. She knew how to make the vision stop, but she wouldn't give in to them. She was stronger than the monsters. No, said Lavanna. I have another idea, princess. A bit of added motivation to assist with your studies. She opened a drawer, smiling serenely. Every movement was graceful and precise. The queen moved like a dancer, always. So controlled, so lovely to watch, even now, despite the cruelty that Winter knew lay beneath her beauty. She waited, expecting a lesson plan or some trivial instructions for practicing her gift. But instead, the queen produced a knife. The handle was carved from milky crystal, and the blade was obsidian black. Like her stepmother, it was both threatening and exquisite. Winter's stomach dropped. Her head spun with alarm, but her feet were cemented to the carpet.
Stepmother?
You will learn to use your gift, Winter. You will not embarrass me and this crown any more than you already have. Pacing toward her, Lavanna held out the knife, handle first. It took a while, but finally Winter forced herself to take it. Her hand was shaking, but she knew that she took the knife of her own will. She was not being coerced. Not yet. She had seen this scene play out dozens of times in the throne room, criminals being sentenced to self-inflicted death.
I don't understand.
You are a very pretty child, Winter. Lavanna's expression remained poised. Winter's arm still trembled. We would not want to ruin that prettiness now, would we? Winter swallowed. Manipulate me, Winter. Go ahead.
What?
She squeaked, certain she'd heard wrong. She'd only practiced on malleable servants in the past. She wasn't sure she could manipulate her stepmother, even if she tried. And she wasn't going to try. She couldn't, not after working so hard to free herself of her lunar instincts. But what was the queen planning? Images of her own throat being slit flashed through Winter's thoughts. Her heart pounded. Prove that you are capable of a simple little manipulation, said Lavanna. That you aren't a waste of my time and my protection. That you aren't the mockery of a princess the people of Artemisia believe you are. Just one little tiny manipulation, and I will let you go. Winter looked down at the knife in her hand. Or, Lavanna continued, her tone sharpening, if you fail, I will give you a new reason to practice your glamour. I will give you something to hide. Believe me, I know how strong that motivation can be. Do you understand? Winter did not understand. She nodded anyway. Her fingers tightened around the cool handle. Go on, then. I will even let you choose what manipulation you will perform. a glamour, an emotion. Make me take that knife back from you if you can. I won't fight you. Lavanna's smile was patient, almost maternal, if Winter had known what a maternal smile looked like. It took a long, long time for the smile to fade. A long, long time for Winter to consider her choice, her decision, her vow. I will never use my gift. Not ever again.
I'm sorry, Winter whispered around her dry throat. I cannot.
The queen held her gaze, passive at first, before Winter saw fury spark in her eyes, an anger that burned hot with loathing. But it soon faded, smothered with mere disappointment.
So be it.
Winter flinched as her hand began to move of its own accord. She slammed her eyes shut against Lavanna's detached expression and saw the vision again, a deep cut in her throat, blood spilling across the floor. Her breath caught as the tip of the blade grazed her neck. Her body went rigid, but the knife didn't cut her throat. It continued up, up, until the sharp point settled against the corner of her right eye. Her gut twisted, her pulse thundered. She gasped as the blade cut into the soft flesh beneath her eye and was dragged slowly down her cheek. She could feel tears welling behind her eyelids from the stinging hot pain, but she kept her eyes shut and refused to let them fall. The blade stopped at her jaw and her hand lowered, taking the knife with it. Winter gulped down a shuddering breath, dizzy with horror, and opened her eyes. She was not dead. She had not lost an eye. She could feel blood dripping down her cheek and throat and catching on the collar of her dress. But it was only a single cut. It was only blood. She blinked rapidly, dispelling any tears before they could betray her, and met her stepmother's hardened glare.
Well, Lavanna said through her teeth, would you like to try again before your beauty is marred further?
Beauty, thought Winter. Of course, it meant so much to the queen, and so very little to her. The pain she could tolerate, the scar she could accept. A new resolve straightened her spine. She would not allow the queen to win this battle. She refused to lose herself to the queen's mind games.
I cannot, she said again.
The knife came to her face again, drawing another parallel line beside the first. This time, she kept her eyes open. She was no longer afraid of crying, though the blood felt like warm, thick tears on her cheek.
And now, Lavanna said, go on, Winter. A simple manipulation. Prove your worth to this court.
Winter held her gaze. Her stepmother's face had lost its calm facade. She was openly livid. Even her shoulders were trembling with restrained rage. They both knew this was no longer about a princess making a mockery of the royal family. Lavanna must have sensed the quiet defiance brewing inside her. The queen could make anyone do anything. She had only to think it, and her will was done. But not this. She could not force Winter to do this. It was a struggle for Winter to keep a proud smile from her face as she said firmly, I will not. Lavanna snarled, and the knife rose again. When the queen released her, Winter refused to run back to her chambers. She walked like royalty, head high and feet clipping steadily on the marble. She didn't even consider using her glamour to hide the three gashes and the blood that dripped down her neck, staining her dress. She was proud. Her wound was proof that she had been to battle and survived. People stopped to stare, but no one asked about the three cuts in her flesh. No one stopped her. Her guards, sworn to defend the princess at all costs, said nothing. The queen would be proven wrong. Winter's skin would be permanently marred, but she would not let the scars bully her into submission. The wounds would become her armor and a constant reminder of her victory. She might be broken. She might be crazy, but she would not be. be defeated. When she reached the wing to her private quarters, she drew up short. Jason was waiting for her outside her chamber doors. Beside him stood head thaumaturge Sybil Mira in her pristine white coat. Jason was staring at the ground, his face tense. Sybil was smiling, a hand on Jason's shoulder. And when they both looked at Winter, Jason appeared shocked first, though it fast turned to horror, while Sybil? Winter shuddered. Sybil Mira looked not surprised at all, and not the tiniest bit sympathetic. Lavanna must have told her what she was planning. Maybe it had even been Sybil's idea. Winter knew that the head thaumaturge had a great amount of influence over the queen. "What happened?" Jason said, shrugging off Sybil's hand and rushing toward her. He went to place his palm over her bloodied cheek, but hesitated. He covered his hand with his sleeve first before pressing the material against her.
"Shall I call for a medic, Your Highness?" said Sybil, folding her hands into her own sleeves.
"I'm fine, thank you. You can step aside so that I might retire to my quarters."
"If you are sure I cannot be of service."
Sybil did step aside, even bowed her head, but an amused smile lingered on her lips as Winter brushed past her. Jason stayed with her, step for step, applying pressure to the cheek that she had not dared touch. It hadn't stopped stinging, and the pain was a persistent reminder of what she had endured and the choices she had made. She would never regret those choices, scars or no.
"Who did this?" Jason demanded
as Winter shoved through her bedroom door, leaving her personal guard outside.
"I did, of course,"
she said, to which he stared aghast. She snorted bitterly.
"My hand did."
His eyes blazed, full of murder.
"The queen?"
She had only to stay silent to confirm it.
Rage cascaded over his face, but he turned away too fast for Winter to appreciate the depth of it.
He pulled her into the powder room and set her on the edge of the tub. Within minutes, he had cleaned the wounds and applied a generous amount of healing salve.
"I shouldn't have left you,"
he muttered through gnashed teeth as he applied a makeshift bandage of cotton strips. Winter was impressed that he was able to keep his hands so calm while his expression was so furious. He would make a great doctor.
"You had no choice," she said. "Neither of us did."
"Why would she do this to you? Is she jealous?"
She met his flashing gaze.
"Why would the queen be jealous of me?"
His anger sizzled.
"How does this benefit her?"
"She said that she wanted me to learn to use my gift, so that I would stop making a mockery of the crown. She thought this would motivate me to learn to use my glamour."
Understanding dawned on his face. "To hide the scars." She nodded.
"I also think she wanted to remind me that I belong to her, that I'm nothing but a pawn in her game, to be used as she sees fit."
She slumped, letting go of the composure she'd fought so hard for.
"But I am not her pawn. I refuse to be."
Jason stood with his hand strangling a towel for a long moment, looking like he wanted to keep working, keep cleaning, keep bandaging. But he'd already done all he could. Finally, with a huff, he sat beside her on the tub's edge. His anger was fading, replaced with guilt.
"If she thinks you're intentionally not using your gift, she might see it as rebellious."
His tone was subdued now, though his finger showed no mercy to the towel.
"I think she is jealous, because people like you, they respect you, and you don't have to manipulate them for it."
"I'm not trying to do anything," said Winter. I just don't want to be like her, like them."
Jason smiled, but it was tired.
"Exactly. What could be more threatening than that?"
She sagged further, settling her face into her hands, careful not to press against her stinging cheek. Then she frowned and peered up at Jason from the corner of her eye.
"What did Thaumaturge Mira want?"
He inhaled sharply. For a moment, she thought he wouldn't say anything, but finally he spoke.
She came to tell me that I would need to find new housing accommodations if my plan is to stay in Artemisia until my internship begins next year. Her brow creased.
New housing? Why wouldn't you stay here, in the palace?
Because my parents are leaving. She straightened. My father's been transferred to one of the outer sectors, as a security guard. Her heart thumped.
A demotion? But why?
Jason started to shake his head, but then stopped and met her gaze, and instantly Winter knew why. She was spending too much time with this boy. She was in love with this boy. And that would not fit into Lavanna's perfectly constructed plans for her. That could cause problems for the Queen and whatever alliance she planned to cement using Winter's hand as the purchase price. Send his family away, and the boy would leave too. She pressed a hand over her mouth. My parents don't seem to mind, said Jason. I think they're both relieved to be getting out of Artemisia. All the politics. And the manipulations, he didn't say, but didn't have to.
You're leaving me, she breathed.
Jason pursed his lips. He looked terrified as he snaked his hand beneath her arm, entwining their fingers together. Their hands fit like a lock and key. It had been years since they had simply held hands, and she wished they had never stopped. No, he said, I'm not leaving you. She raised her eyes. There was a determined set to his jaw that surprised her.
But where will you go if you can't stay here? She asked. And besides, when your internship starts, you'll have to leave anyway, and then...
Thaumaturge Mira gave me another option. Or, he gulped, the Queen gave me another option. They've invited me to join the palace guard. I could begin training as early as next week. Her eyes widened, and she yanked her hand away.
No! No, Jason, you can't! What about being a doctor? What about...
I could stay with you, Winter. I could stay here in the palace.
Until they send you off to one of the outer sectors, you mean?
They won't do that.
How can you be sure?
Because I'll be the most loyal guard Her Majesty has ever known. His expression was withdrawn, haunted. Winter's hand went slack in his grip. Lavanna would threaten her, maybe even threaten her life. Maybe she already had. Which was how they'd gotten Jason to consider it in the first place. He would do anything they asked if he thought he was protecting her. You know how we all take aptitude tests in year 14? Jason said, unable to look at her. I tested high for a potential pilot role. Thaumaturge Mira said she could use me as her personal guard and transporter.
No, Jason, you can't. If you do this, you'll never be able to get out.
Releasing her hand, he stood up and began pacing the powder room floor. I don't know what else to do. I can't leave you here, especially now after this. He waved a hand toward her cheek, and Winter placed her palm over the washcloth. The blood hadn't yet soaked through.
I don't want you to be a guard, Jason. Not after what happened to my father.
Her voice cracked. Killed by a thaumaturge, with no hope at all of defending himself, because he was weak. Jason was weak. She was weak. Against the Queen and her court, they had no hope at all. Pawns. Just pawns.
I think you should go, she said.
He stared at her, hurt.
With your parents, I mean. I think you should go with them. In a year, apply for your medical internship and be the doctor you've always wanted to be. This is what you want, Jason, to help people, to save people.
Winter, I... She gasped, her gaze catching on the wall over Jason's shoulder. A frosted glass window was there, letting in enough daylight to make the entire room glow rosy and gold. But the light was being blotted out by blood. Crimson, thick, sticky blood oozing from the mortar that held in the glass windowpane, dripping thickly down the sides and pooling on the sill. She started to tremble,
Jason spun around, following the look. He was silent a long moment before saying,
"What? What's wrong?"
He looked back at her. Something splattered on Winter's forearm. She tilted her head back. The ceiling. Covered in it. Red. Everywhere. The tang of iron on her tongue. Her mouth was thick with it. Her chest convulsed with panic and nausea. She shoved herself to her feet and spun in a full circle, watching as the blood came down from the ceiling, soaking into the gilt wallpaper and wood moldings, puddling on the tile floor.
Winter, what is it? What are you seeing?
The blood reached her toes. She turned and shoved past him, scrambling out of the powder room.
Winter!
Her bedroom was no better. She froze in the middle of it. Blood had made a waterfall over her bed, staining the linens in crimson, squishing in the carpet beneath her feet. The door into the corridor had a bloodied curtain dripping from the jamb. No getting through. No getting away. She stumbled and teetered on her weak legs, then tripped toward the only escape, the doors that led to the balcony. She heard Jason screaming behind her, and she hoped he would follow, hoped he would not get stuck here in the suffocating stench, the incessant dripping. She threw open the doors. Her stomach hit the protective barrier. Her hands latched on to the rail. The blood kept coming, pouring out of the bedroom, spilling over the balcony, dribbling down to the garden. It was the palace. The whole palace was bleeding. It would fill up the entire lake. Gasping for air, she hauled one leg up and threw herself over the rail. Arms locked around her just as her center of balance tilted forward. Her stomach swooped, but Jason was hauling her back into the room. She shrieked and clawed, demanding that he let her go. If he didn't, she would drown. They would both be swallowed alive. He wrestled her to the warm, sticky carpet and pinned her wrists to either side of her head.
Winter, stop!
He cried, leaning down and pressing his cheek against hers in an attempt to soothe her.
It's all right, Winter. You're all right.
She turned her head and snapped her teeth at him. He pulled back far enough that she barely missed his ear. She screamed in frustration, writhing and kicking, but Jason refused to yield.
You're all right, he whispered again and again. I'm here.
Winter had no idea how long the hallucination lasted, how long she struggled, trying to get away from the blood that cascaded over every surface of the room, a room that had once seemed a sanctuary. Sanctuary. There was no safe place, not in Artemisia, not on all of Luna, except Jason. When her screams succumbed to hysterical sobbing, Jason finally allowed his hold to turn from the grip of a jailer to the embrace of her best friend.
This is why, he whispered.
And it occurred to Winter that, at some point, he'd started crying too.
This is why I can't leave you, Winter. This is why I'll never leave.
The nightmare came again, and again, weeks of it, incessant. Gunshots, dead eyes, blood sprayed on the bedroom walls. Only this time, the queen did not simply curl herself against her dead husband and cry and cry and cry. This time, she took the knife that she had used to stab the thaumaturge, and she carved 3 straight lines into the cheek of Winter's father. Winter tried so hard to stay strong, knowing that every time she sought out Jason's security, it would further cement his decision to stay. So she rocked herself in her bed and tried to whisper comfort into her own blankets. Until the night she could stand it no longer. He was the only place that was safe. Her night clothes still damp from the terrors, she rushed out of her quarters, pretending not to notice the night guard who followed in her wake. Jason would hold her. Jason would comfort her. Jason would keep the nightmares at bay. Except, Jason was gone. That's what they told her when she arrived, pounding on the apartment door that the Clays had shared with 2 other families. He and his family had been transferred the day before, and she hadn't even known. He hadn't even told her. He hadn't said goodbye. Demoted. Transferred. gone. Shocked and heartbroken, Winter retreated. She wandered blindly back toward the main corridor of the palace. Gone. She'd told him to go. She'd believed it would be for the best. It was the only way for him to have a chance at happiness. He had to get away from Artemisia, away from the queen, away from her. And yet, she had not believed he would really go. Jason, her dearest friend, her only friend, just like Celine, just like her father. They all left.
When, princess?
She froze, slowly turned. It was him, but not him. A hallucination, because this could not be her Jason wearing the pressed uniform of a garden training, his blonde hair tucked behind his ears, not quite long enough to be tied back. He stood with his arms stiff at his sides, like he was waiting to carry out orders. Not a smile, not a teasing glint in his eye, barely even recognition.
Jason,
she whispered to the phantom that looked like her best friend. His Adam's apple bobbed with what looked to be a painful gulp. Then, his jaw set and he clicked his heels together awkwardly. His gaze lifted away from her eyes, staring at the wall in the distance, with the same vacant expression that all the guards had. The same emptiness.
Shall I escort you to your quarters, princess?
Every bit the guard. Winter, by habit, found herself drawing her shoulders back, a defense. She would hide behind politeness and grace. Every bit the princess. It was strange how quickly it started to feel normal. They had played this game before, she realized. 100 times they had played it. He, the loyal guard. She, the princess he must protect.
Yes, she said as loudly as her voice would allow. Thank you, Sir Clay.
A slight shake of his head. Squire Clay, your highness. Guard in training.
Squire Clay.
She gulped and slowly turned her back on him, walking dazedly back through the halls. He followed behind her, respectful and distant. Over her shoulder, she dared a nervous smile.
If you aren't too busy with your training later, Squire Clay, I fear I might need rescuing from a pirate.
His eyelid twitched. He did not look at her, and he didn't smile, but she caught it, just for a moment, the light entering his eyes.
It would be my honor, princess.
The Little Android. Mech 6.0 stood against the hangar's charging wall, one of hundreds of mute sentinels watching the passengers flutter by with their hovering luggage carts and excited chatter. Before her, the massive Triton hunkered imposingly in the center of the hangar, dwarfing the crowd, as greeters scanned the ID chips of their guests and ushered them aboard. A ship's maiden voyage was always a festive occasion, but this one seemed more vibrant than usual, as the Triton was about to set the record for largest cruiser ever to be launched. Waiters were passing glasses of champagne to the passengers as they boarded and had their belongings escorted away. Women were donning their finest kimonos and hanbok and cocktail gowns, and a live orchestra had even been hired for the entertainment. Against the festive backdrop, the ship itself appeared menacing to Mech 6.0. With its polished metal paneling and small round windows glinting beneath the hangar's lights. It hadn't seemed so big when she'd been working on it, running wires and soldering frame pieces and screwing on protective paneling. At the time, she'd almost felt like she and her brethren were a part of this enormous metal beast, 1,000 tiny moving pieces making one efficient machine. But now, the result of their labors was ready to set sail, and she no longer felt attached to it at all, only dwarfed by its magnificence, and perhaps a little abandoned. As the guests giggled and chattered and discussed how many space cruises they'd been on before, and the beauty of the new ship, and all the comforts the ads had promised, Mech 6.0 watched and listened and felt the thrumming of electricity warming her insides.
All aboard! Triton to debark in 10 minutes. 10-minute warning! All aboard!
The crowd dwindled. The monotonous beep of the ID scanners trickled to an occasional sparse rhythm. One ramp rose up to the ship, closing with the thud that vibrated through the hangar's floors and up Mech 6.0's treads. Then two ramps. Then three.
Wait! A woman's voice echoed through the hangar, followed by the hasty padding of feet. We're coming! We're here! She said breathlessly, dragging a young girl behind her.
Just in time, said one of the greeters, scanning the woman's wrist. On up you go. She thanked him profusely and pushed a lock of messy hair off her face. Retightening her grip on the girl's wrist, she gave her floating hover car a push and jogged up the ramp. Mech 6.0's scanner caught on something small and flat as it dislodged from the young girl's backpack and fluttered down toward the greeter, who didn't notice. Her programming alerted her to the incongruence, and she shuffled through proper responses. If she found something that a human had lost or that had been stolen, she was to return it. But she was not to interrupt the boarding process, particularly once the captain had called for the ship to be sealed and prepared for takeoff. As soon as the ramp began to rise off the ground, Mech 6.0 knew that her opportunity to return the item to the girl was lost. She kept her scanner pinned to that small card until the ramp tilted up and up and the card slipped off and came spinning and twirling through the air. Past the greeters who were already pulling back the ropes for the ticketing lines, past the statue-like forms of her brothers and sisters, past the hired musicians, until it landed against Mech 6.0's own treads and stuck there. The roar of the ship's engines pulled her attention back toward the Triton, and her scanner lifted up and up as the hangar ceiling began to open. The gears cranked and rumbled, revealing first a teasing hint of moonlight, and then a gap filled with stars. Then slowly, an entire galaxy opened up above the hangar. It was beautiful. Mech 6.0 loved this moment, anticipated it every time they completed a new project and prepared to send it off into the sky. That short glimpse of the galaxy was not like anything else in her world. A world that was normally filled with mechanics and tools and the dark, shadowy spaces inside a quiet, lonely spaceship. The galaxy, she had come to understand, was vast and bright and endless. A surge of electricity startled Mech 6.0, like a spark straight to the processor that was protected beneath her torso paneling. Startled, she turned her head to peer down the line of identical androids. To her left first, and then to her right. Not only did they not seem to have felt the sudden surge, but none of them were even looking up at the overhead sky. Stiff and uncurious, they remained staring straight ahead. Mech 6.0 returned her attention to the ship as it rose up off the ground and hovered on the magnetic field beneath the hangar's roof. The thrusters burned white hot for a moment, and the ship rose higher and higher, breaching the ceiling before it swooped gracefully up toward the starry night sky and disappeared. As the cheers died out and the crowd began to disperse, the musicians began packing up their instruments. The enormous ceiling lowered in on itself and clanged, shutting them in tight again. And not long after the space had cleared, the lights shut off with three loud bangs, plunging the mech droids into pitch blackness and silence. 4 minutes passed in which Mech 6.0 was still remembering the view of the stars, which she knew were somehow always there and yet always out of her reach, before she remembered the girl's lost card. Her sensor light flickered on, creating a circle of pale blue light around her. Her neighbors swiveled their heads, perhaps in curiosity, but more likely in disapproval. But she ignored them as she cast the scanner down toward her treads. Extending her arm, she pinched the card between her padded grippers and held it up. It was thin but stiff, like a sheet of aluminum, and on one side was scrolled in fancy, shiny lettering, Celebrity Hollows, Collector Set, 39th Edition, 124 TE. She turned the card over, and a flickering pale holograph rose up from it and began to rotate. She was looking at the likeness of a teenage boy who seemed vaguely familiar, with shaggy black hair and a relaxed smile. Mech 6.0 felt her fans stutter in an odd way and wondered if there might be something wrong with her internals. If this kept up, she was going to have to alert the maintenance mechanic. But this thought was fleeting as she opened the hollow storage compartment on her abdomen and tucked the holographic card inside. Maybe she would return it one day, she considered, although her statistical calculations told her that it would probably never happen. 2 days passed before Mech 6.0 was given a new assignment, along with 14 of her fellow mech droids. She stood in line with others as Tam Sovan, the shipyard's owner, paced around the project's underside, inspecting the landing gear and discussing the plans with their new client, Ochida Kenji. Ochida Shifu was a middle-aged man with a little facial hair and a very expensive-looking suit. His ship was a recreational yacht, luxurious and spacious enough for those who could afford luxury in space. Mech 6.0 scanned the ship while she waited to receive her instructions, plugging the information into her database. A 94 TE Orion Classic, one of the most expensive ships of its day, and one of the most popular for refurbishing over the past decade. The name Child of the Stars had been painted near its nose, but had faded with time.
"The body is in good shape, Ochida Shifu," said Tam, "but we're looking at a full engine rebuild to bring it up to code, and remodeling the interior to include all the most modern amenities will require that we take it down to the paneling. I am confident we can meet your deadline, though, while maintaining the ship's original character."
"Your reputation speaks for itself," said Ochida Kenji. "I have no doubt she's in good hands."
"Excellent. Let me introduce you to the engineer who will be heading up your rebuild. This is Wing Dataran, one of our brightest stars."
Like a programmed reflex, Mech 6.0's sensor swiveled toward the group. Though Wing Dataran had been working at the shipyard for almost a year, their paths had never crossed. The Triton had been much too big, and she had never been assigned to any of his smaller projects. But she had known about him. She had connected him to the net database the first time she'd seen him, as she did with all of her human employers. But something about him had kept that profile in the forefront of her memory. A young hardware engineer, he had been hired straight out of Tech University, where he had specialized in spaceship engines with additional concentrations in internal design and mechanical systems. For reasons that didn't fully compute, she frequently found her sensor seeking him out in the crowd of androids and technicians, and every time she spotted him, her fan did that strange little jump, like it had when she'd seen the holograph. Only now did she realize that there were similarities between Dataran and the holographic figure. Not only in how all humans were similar, with their two eyes and protruding noses and five-fingered fleshy hands, but Dataran and the boy in the holograph both had pronounced cheekbones and slender frames that suggested a particular grace, and they had both made her fans sputter. What did that mean? Dataran unclipped a port screen from his tool belt after they'd finished their introductions.
"I've already begun working up some initial plans," he said, showing something on the screen to Ochida. "But I want to discuss with you any special requests you might have before I finalize them, particularly those new luxury features, which can put added stress on the engine. I want to make sure it's fully..."
He trailed off, eyes snagging on something over Ochida's shoulder. Everyone followed his gaze, including Mech 6.0. A girl had emerged from the ship, wearing an orange and white kimono.
"Ah, there you are, my princess," said Ochida, waving her down toward them.
"Have you been inside the ship this whole time?"
Just saying goodbye, said the girl, floating down the ramp. When I see her again, it will be like meeting an entirely new ship.
Don't be ridiculous. You and I are going to be involved every step of the way, making sure my little girl is given precisely the ship she wants.
Ochita wrapped an arm around her shoulders before raising an eyebrow at Tam Sovan.
If that isn't a problem.
Of course not. We welcome your input and want to make sure you're fully satisfied with the end result.
Good, good. Gentlemen, this is my daughter, Maiko. I may have my opinions and my wallet, but she's the one you really have to please with this rebuild. Think of it as her ship, not mine.
Maiko dipped her head respectfully toward the shipyard owner and Dadaran, who stood straighter when her eyes met his.
This is a very busy place, said Maiko, glancing around at the ships of varying sizes and states of construction, at all the men and women and androids scurrying around their landing gears and wheeling enormous toolboxes back and forth. How can you keep it all straight?
Each project has a separate crew assigned to it, said Tam, and they'll stay focused on that one project from beginning to completion. We find it the most efficient use of our workers.
Her gaze settled on Dadaran again. And you will be on our crew? There was a tinge of color in his cheeks, Mech 6.0 noticed. Perhaps it was warmer than usual in the hangar, although she didn't come equipped with atmospheric temperature gauges to tell for sure.
Yes, Ochita Mei, he stammered. I'll be your engineer. I'll be the one pleasing...
His flush deepened. You can call me Maiko, she said with a friendly smile. I know a little about mechanics myself, but perhaps I'll learn something new from you during this process. He opened his mouth to reply, but no sound came out.
Why don't we get these androids started on some of the exterior dismantling, said Tam. And Dadaran. Perhaps you could give Ochita Mei a tour of the shipyard while we sign off on some papers.
Oh, of course, he said, stumbling to replace the port screen on his belt.
He dislodged a small, shiny chain, which he quickly tucked back into his pocket.
If you would like that.
I would, very much. As her father nudged her forward, Maiko reached for the back of her neck to adjust the hair that was bundled there, and Mech 6.0's sensor picked up on something small and dark that suggested an abnormality. A birthmark, perhaps? Or a tattoo? As her processor received its first set of instructions, Mech 6.0 claimed a spot near the front of the ship, where she could back out screws while keeping her sensor turned toward the bustling hangar. She watched as Dadaran pointed out the various machinery and ship models and tried to guess what he might be telling Ochita Maiko about. The purpose of the different tools? The history of the ships? How they had the most efficient system of android labor in any shipyard in the Commonwealth? She saw him introducing the girl to different mechanics and engineers who they passed. For a while, they disappeared into the almost completed Windwalker 800, and Mech 6.0 could only catch glimpses of them through the cockpit window. She noticed they were both smiling. Dadaran took Maiko through parts storage, the painting room, even past the android charging docks, and while Mech 6.0 couldn't hear them, she frequently recognized the dimples of his laughter and noticed how his gazes grew more daring, settling on the girl with increased frequency, just as her gazes settled on him. By the time Dadaran was opening the gate and ushering Maiko up onto the platforms that hung suspended over the water supply and refueling tanks, Mech 6.0 realized that she had stopped working. She turned her sensor toward the ship's paneling that had only two screws still fastening it to the hull, then glanced at her brethren beside her. They all had at least three panels already taken down. This was very odd. Not only her strange fascination with the humans, but that it could overpower her need to complete her task. Perhaps something really was wrong with her.
Yes, she would have to check in with maintenance after this shift. Then, as she was removing her first panel, someone yelled. Mech 6.0 turned in time to see one of the enormous cranes tilt beneath a too heavy load, its outstretched arm swaying dangerously for a moment that stretched out for ages before it found the tipping point. The enormous metal arm fell toward the suspended platforms, bolts snapping and cables whipping into the air. Still on the hanging walkway, Maiko screamed. Dataran pushed her out of the way. The arm of the crane cracked against his head, the sound reverberating right into Mech 6.0's hard plastic shell. He was unconscious before his body fell into the oil vat below. Maiko screamed again, clinging to the walkway railing. The crane landed hard, and one of the cables flew loose from the ceiling. The platform careened to one side, but the remaining cables held. Mech 6.0 did not take the time to process the situation or calculate the best course of action. She was already rolling toward the containers. Around her, people yelled, and machinery screeched and halted, footsteps thundered, and the rickety walkway trembled overhead. Someone called for a ladder or a rope, but Mech 6.0 already had her magnets activated to collect the panel screws, and with single-minded precision, she found herself climbing the side of the enormous tank, her grippers spread out against its metal sides, heaving her body upward. It was an awkward climb. One her body was not made for, as her treads banged against the tank and her arms flailed for the next purchase. Her joints strained under her weight. But then, she was hauling herself up onto the ledge, which was just barely wide enough for her to stand on. The vat of oil was black as the night sky without stars. Black and terrifying. Mech 6.0 tipped herself over and went in. She sank fast, and though she immediately turned her sensor light on to full brightness, it did little to help her. Extending her arms as far as they would go, she searched the bottom of the tank, knowing that he was here somewhere. He was here. He was... here. She tightened her grippers and dragged her body toward him, through the thick oil. It was seeping through her paneling now, blocking her input plugs, glugging into the charging inlet. But she had him. She wrapped her arms around his torso and heaved him upward. He was heavier than she expected, and it occurred to her that the bolts connecting her arms to their sockets might not hold, but she kept going. Finding the tank's wall, she planted her prongs against the side again and started to climb. There was no light anymore, no senses at all but the sound of her grippers and the tread bumping into the wall, and the pressure of his body pressing down onto her as she forced both of them up, up, up. They broke through the surface. Sound crashed into her, more screams and gasps. Then someone was lifting his weight away, and Mech 6.0 barely managed to collapse sensor face down onto the tank's ledge before her programming recognized self-destructive behavior and killed the power to her limbs. She laid there, hollow and helpless, as the oil dripped off her sensor. She began to make out human shapes on the platform, and her audio picked up on a discussion of towels and air passageways and lungs and blood on his head. And it seemed to take so very long. The oil dulling all her senses. But then he was coughing and vomiting and breathing. And the humans were rejoicing. And when they had finally wiped enough oil from his face that it was safe for him to open his eyes, Dataran looked around at all the humans first, and then, for the very first time, he looked at her. Dataran had been taken away to a hospital, and Mech 6.0 was in the android maintenance office, her limbs being rubbed clean, or as clean as possible, by a man in green coveralls who kept shaking his head.
"These won't be salvageable either," he said, clicking his tongue as he inspected her input plugs.
He wasn't doing a particularly good job of cleaning her, Mech 6.0 thought, and she was feeling more sluggish and drained by the minute. It began to occur to her that maybe she couldn't be fixed, that maybe he wouldn't even try. Sighing, the man spun around on his rolling chair so he could enter something into a net screen on the wall. Mech 6.0 glanced down at her body, her joints and the seams of her paneling stained brownish-black from the oil. At least her vision was clear again, and her processor seemed to be working, if slower than usual. She was surprised to see a collection of screws still clinging to her side from where she'd been removing the panel from the Orion Classic. She reached her grippers toward them, glad to see that her sensor-gripper coordination was functional as she plucked them off one by one and set them on the mechanic's table. She reached for the final screw and tugged. Then, paused, then tugged some more. It was not a screw at all, but the link of a chain that had wrapped around to her back. She gave the chain a yank, and whatever had magnetically sealed itself to her came loose. She found herself staring at a locket, which she suspected would have been gold if it wasn't blackened by the oil. Her memory saw Dataran tucking a chain back into his pocket. This belonged to him. The mechanic spun back toward her, and she hid the locket behind her back. He was eyeing her suspiciously and shaking his head again when the office door opened and the shipyard's owner came strolling in.
Well?
The mechanic shook his head.
Its body is ruined. I could spend a couple weeks trying to clean it up, but I frankly don't see the point. Better off just getting a new one.
Tam frowned as he looked the android up and down.
What about the processor? The wiring? Can it be salvaged?
There will probably be some parts we can hold on to for later use. I'll start to dismantle it tomorrow, see what we've got. But as for the processor and personality chip, that much must have been fritzing even before the oil.
Why do you say that?
The mechanic brushed his sleeve across his damp forehead.
You saw how all the other androids reacted when Dataran fell in?
I don't think they did anything.
Exactly. That's what they're supposed to do. Just keep working, not get involved with drama and upsets. What this one did, it isn't normal. Something's wrong with it.
A spark flickered inside Mech 6.0's head. She'd begun to suspect as much, but to have it confirmed was worrisome.
What do you think it is?
Who knows? You hear stories about this once in a while. Androids whose artificial intelligence reaches a point of learning at which they develop almost human-like tendencies. Unpractical reasoning, near-emotional responses. There are plenty of theories for why it happens, but the important thing is, it isn't good.
I'm not sure I agree, the owner crossed his arms over his chest. This mech droid may have saved Dataran's life today.
I realize that, and thank the stars, but what will it do next time there's a disturbance? The fact is, an unpredictable android is a dangerous one.
He shrugged.
My advice? Either send out the computer for reprogramming, or scrap it entirely.
Pressing his lips into a thin line, Tam let his gaze travel over Mech 6.0's body. She squeezed the locket tighter in her three-fingered grasp.
Fine, Tam said, but let's worry about it tomorrow. I think we could all use the rest of the night off.
They left her on the table in the mechanics room, and as the lights of the shipyard thudded into blackness, Mech 6.0 realized it was the first night in her existence that she hadn't been plugged into the charging dock. Because charging her wasn't necessary. Because tomorrow she would be dismantled and put on a shelf somewhere, and the bits of her that weren't worth saving would be sent off to the scrapyard. Tomorrow, she would be gone. She analyzed those words for a long time, her processor whirring and sputtering around them, trying to calculate the hours and minutes left in her existence before there would be only a black hole where her consciousness had been before. She wondered if Dataran would give a single thought to the malfunctioning android who had saved his life and been destroyed for it. Dataran. She had something that belonged to him now. It was in her code to return it to him if she could.
She brought the locket up in front of her sensor and scanned its dimensions and the small hinge and the tiny unlocking mechanism. It was a challenge to open with her clumsy prongs, but finally she did. And the galaxy expanded before her. The holograph filled up the entire office. The sun and the planets, the stars and the nebulas, asteroids and comets, and all the beauty of space contained in that tiny, unimpressive little locket. Mech 6.0 clicked it shut, storing the universe away in its small prison once again. No, she couldn't stay here. She could not stand to be lost to the darkness forever, when there was still a whole universe she'd never seen. Mech 6.0 had never been outside of the shipyard before, not since she'd been programmed and built and purchased. She quickly discovered that the world was chaotic and loud and filled with so much sensory information, she worried that her frazzled synapses would be fried before she ever reached her destination. But she tried to focus on the map of New Beijing and the profile she'd discovered on the net as she turned into the first street of market booths, crowded with barrels of spices and woven blankets that hung from wire racks and net screens chattering from every surface. "Robotic cats, 2 for the price of 1, today only. No shedding, just purring. Depression? Low energy? Infertility? What's your ailment? We have cures. We even have the newest prevention drops for the blue fever. Tried and true. Plum wine, rice wine, come try a free sample. Big sale on Servdroids. Now's the time to upgrade. New models just in." She kept her sensor down and attempted to look inconspicuous. The net was filled with stories of android theft, and she was worried that being crushed together with so many humans, she would soon find herself snatched up and saddled with some new owner, who would no doubt have her dismantled anyway once they discovered her damage. Finally, she spotted a nondescript booth just where the market directory had said it would be. The walls were lined with shelves that sagged from their jumble of tools and android parts and outdated port screens stacked 3 layers deep. Mech 6.0 rolled up to the table that blocked the entrance. A girl was standing near the back of the booth, wearing thick work gloves and cargo pants, scanning something with a port screen. She paused and tapped her fingers against the screen, then reshuffled some items on the shelf before scanning another item.
"Pardon me," said Mech 6.0, her sensors crackling at the effort.
She did not have many opportunities to speak at the shipyard, and the long trek had already drained her power source. The girl glanced toward her.
"Oh, sorry, I'll be with you in just a minute."
She finished entering whatever data she was working on and clipped the port screen to her belt.
"How can I help you?"
"Looking for Lynn Cinder."
"You found her?"
The girl tilted her head to one side, furrowing her brow.
"Is your voice box on the fritz?"
"Whole body," said Mech 6.0. "Purchase new?"
It took a moment, but then Lynn Cinder nodded.
"Oh, sure. I can do that. Is your owner around?"
Mech 6.0 felt a sudden drop in power, but was relieved when it was only a temporary loss. Now that she'd found the mechanic, she shut off her net database in order to conserve what energy she could.
"No owner."
Lynn Cinder's brow furrowed. Her eyes darted to the android dealer across the way.
"Oh, I see."
She reached for her port screen again and set it on the table between them, before typing in a few commands.
"Well, all right, so I can order up a replacement mech body today, but it usually takes about a week to get here, unless the warehouse downtown has some in stock. You're a 6.0, right? It doesn't look like they have any. Do you mind waiting a week?"
"Can I wait here?"
Hesitating, Cinder glanced over her shoulder at the booth, cluttered with machines and toolboxes. Then she shrugged.
Sure, I could probably clear a space for you.
Tightening her ponytail, she sat down in the chair that had been pushed beneath the table.
But if you don't have an owner, how do you plan on paying for this?
Paying. Money, currency, univs, to give compensation for goods or services. Androids did not get paid.
Trade, said Mech 6.0.
Trade? Cinder dipped her gaze over Mech 6.0's battered form.
For what?
Mech 6.0 opened the compartment in her abdomen. Her prongs found the metal locket on its chain first and wrapped around it. Her fan slowed, almost stopped. Releasing the locket, she searched again, and her grippers emerged with a small holographic card instead. She placed it on the table. Removing the glove from her right hand, Cinder picked up the card and flipped it over, reading the words on the back before turning it so the holograph projected from the flat surface.
A Prince Kai holographic trading card, she muttered, rubbing her brow with her gloved hand. Because that's all I need.
Sighing, she peered at Mech 6.0 again.
I'm sorry, but this is only worth about 20 micro-univs. It would barely buy you a screw.
She looked truly regretful as she handed the card back. Mech 6.0 pinched it gently between her prongs.
Do you have anything else?
Her processor pulsed. The locket. But it was not hers. It belonged to Dataran, and she was